touchdown machine for the Houston Cougars.
Sasser again, just kind of taking over right now.
That's NBA stuff right there. He is a baller.
Stick it in your pipe and smoke it, baby.
Yes! Welcome to Scott Holland Podcast, coming to you this week with, stop me if this sounds familiar, a jam-packed episode. We have a little bit of everything tonight. A Cougar team in the NCAA postseason, another one that just completed their conference championships, and yet another on the verge of closing a surprisingly really strong conference season, closing the regular season, looking ahead to the postseason there, chasing a conference championship. Not to mention, we have Big 12 schedule releases for multiple Cougar sports, a notable portal addition for the football team, which the portal seems to be its own year-round process. And just this afternoon, a spicy report from a little-known up-and-coming NBA reporter at ESPN concerning Kelvin Sampson. I called it last week a smorgasbord, Dustin, but I would say this week we have something more like a buffet. I was going to start comparing those various topics I listed off to buffet menu items, but I realized I haven't eaten at an honest-to-goodness buffet since before COVID, so I'm going to stop embarrassing myself and just ask you, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well. I like that buffet analogy, actually. In fact, my first point was just kind of, I thought it was interesting that we had, you know, three Cougar sports still in season this past week, and we had one of them finish up their season at, you know, in the NCAA postseason. We had one of them competing at conference championships and then has the NCAA postseason to come, and then we have one still finishing up the regular season with conference championships just over the horizon. But kind of like you mentioned, we also had a player addition, and we had some player, you know, news, and we had, as you mentioned, some spicy coaching news. So truly just a little bit of everything. So I'm doubling down your buffet analogy, Sam. I like that one.
I'm going to say the Kelvin Sampson news is the dessert that gives you indigestion that you think might be a heart attack, but you're just like, okay, this isn't actually as bad as I thought it was. So that's, I'm going to stick with that and then not embarrass myself any further. So, of course, got to make my obligatory and weekly mention for our good friends and network partners at the 1012 Network, who you can follow if you have not done so already on Twitter at TEN12 Network. Subscribe to the 1012 podcast wherever you put podcasts in your ears. And we would also be truly honored and grateful for any and all of you who, one, already support our podcast, and two, who might consider doing in the future by going to patreon.com/shpawdcast. You won't be just be supporting us. You'll also be giving yourself access to our collection of premium episodes for as little as $5 a month. And got to mention, of course, our good friends at the good brand Home Field Apparel, homefieldapparel.com, makers of incredibly comfortable vintage collegiate apparel. I am generally wearing our Cougar tees. It's an audio-only medium, Dustin. I have to take my word for it. I'm generally wearing a Home Field Cougar tee. I'm not wearing a Cougar tee this week, but I am wearing a Home Field FAU basketball shirt where Owl the Owl is like holding his arms out in the universal "what are you looking at, bro" gesture. Guys will know what I'm talking about out there. Really great, awesome vintage design. You can get a great Houston Cougar collection, many great vintage designs there, and you're going to save 15% off if you have not made the fantastic decision to support our good friends at Homefield. You can get 15% off your first order by using the promo code Holman12, H-O-L-M-A-N-1-2, like Scott and Holman. If you did not win life's lottery and you are an interested observer but not a Cougar fan listening to the show, and believe it or not, there are a non-zero number of you out there, you could save on any of Homefield's incredible collection of hundreds of schools. That's homefieldapparel.com, promo code Holman12, makers of incredibly comfortable vintage tees. You're going to look good doing it, and using that promo code, you're going to support our podcast and our good friends in the process. Dustin, I was thinking as I kind of put my thoughts together in this first story about the what if we had decided Tuesday night was the perfect night to record this show. What if we had been 19, 20 hours too early to talk about a story that kind of surprised all of us, certainly. And I'm sure put a non-zero amount of fear into a number of Cougar fans when Adrian Wojnarowski, I don't know, Dusty, he could think about shortening.
Sounds pretty correct to me.
Shortening that is something called Woj. You know, I don't want to give career advice to this young man, but but Woj reported that Kelvin Sampson had interviewed with the Milwaukee Bucks, who have a head coaching vacancy after dismissing Mike Budenholzer after, I think, a somewhat unexpected early playoff exit for that franchise. Dusty, I'm not going to pretend like I wasn't surprised by the news, so I'm going to toss it to you here by kind of asking, what was your initial thoughts upon seeing the story besides maybe an obscenity like, oh, bleep. What were your kind of first fully formed thoughts about this story?
It was just kind of like, huh. It was something that when it happened, it surprised me, but it kind of as soon as I thought about it, it made some amount of sense. Because on the one hand, if you had asked me yesterday, you know, do you think Kelvin Sampson will retire with U of H, I would have said, oh yeah, almost certainly. And even now, I think if I have to say yes, no, I would still say yes. I think he's going to retire from the University of Houston. He certainly made it sound like that's what he wants to do. But at the same time, you know, the Bucks need a coach. And, man, if you're asked, and it's not like, you know, this is not some struggling NBA team. I mean, like, hey, do you want to come and try to start up and try to make something out of this struggling, which I think Kelvin Sampson wouldn't bother fielding the call of a situation like that, you know, just given where he's at in his career. But, yeah, if the team that was just the number one seed in the East that's got one of the best handful of players in the world in Giannis on the roster, if that team gives you a call, you take the call, right? You'd be crazy not to take the call. What coach realistically is not going to field a call like that? And it certainly sounds like it's been kind of this weird ongoing. I don't follow the NBA that closely, but it sounds like it's been kind of a weird ongoing coaching search where they've interviewed, like, a bunch of guys at this point, so I don't know. Really where they're going, but it certainly sounds like from, you know, the things that were coming out with, you know, Kelvin Sampson texting the Chronicle tonight and saying that he's, you know, looking forward to coaching in the Big 12 next year and everything, and it's certainly in the, you know, a source categorized it as not even an interview, but he had a visit with the Bucks. He didn't interview, he visited with the Milwaukee Bucks. And then the other shoe dropping being, you know, an hour after that or whatever when it was announced, or not announced, but at least reported by Joseph Duarte that U of H was working on a restructured deal with Kelvin Sampson, so kind of did all, oh yeah, hey, let's not forget that this guy isn't, you know, it's not impossible for him to go take a job somewhere else, and he is a truly one-of-a-kind coach in terms of, you know, there's, you can't go out and just hire another Kelvin Sampson if Kelvin Sampson leaves. Not that I, you know, again, and we'll get into this in a little bit, I'm sure, but not that I don't think that Kelvin Sampson's going to do a great job, but just, you know, objectively, Kelvin Sampson's a Hall of Fame coach, and when a Hall of Fame coach leaves, it's not always, you can't always replicate that, so it's never a good situation. So, understandable that people are concerned, but at the end of the day, I certainly, my money is on Kelvin Sampson still being here next year, and, you know, I think we can talk about it a little bit. You know, if it is Kellen, I mean, whenever that transition happens, I think Kellen will do a great job here, so I'm not overly concerned about that. But, you know, would definitely nonetheless still love Kelvin Sampson to be around for another few years and kind of handle the transition to the Big 12 at the very least.
And there's no way, really, just about any college program can prevent itself from potentially having a coach poached by the NBA. Well, let's remind ourselves, this is the pinnacle of the sport. Even a bad NBA job, it's still, there's a very few number of them. And it's just, I know Kelvin Sampson loves being a college coach. I know he came back to college coaching after, I think, being on a pretty good trajectory when he was an assistant under Kevin McHale. Why do I want to call him Kelvin McHale? With the Houston Rockets. But there's just no way you can really future-proof against that happening. I think, other than the fact that Kelvin Sampson genuinely likes his job, that Kelvin Sampson is at the point in his career where he could do what he wants. He can go to work with his son and daughter every day who hold their positions in the Cougar program, that he can be able to see his grandkids on a pretty regular basis and just be in a job where just there is, I would say, very few, if any, cooler seats in Division I men's basketball than the one Kelvin Sampson has at the University of Houston. You can't, I think, throw that out. But that still being said, if the Milwaukee Bucks are really serious, and it is incorrect, let's just say hypothetically, not saying that myself, that the Bucks really are seriously considering him as one of their biggest candidates for the job, there's no way he can get turned down an NBA job where he has an existing relationship with the GM from his several years of being an assistant under Scott Skiles there previously, and to coach Giannis Antetokounmpo, who's one of the very, 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 very best on the planet at the sport, a recent champion. There's just no way you could turn that down. That being said, as much as I am just the biggest Kelvin Sampson stan on the planet, I have a hard time seeing an NBA franchise that did something as bold and surprising as getting rid of a head coach who not that long ago won an NBA championship and just guided said team to a really successful regular season, not getting into the whole, you know, why they would or wouldn't fire him, but that you would get rid of Mike Budenholzer, a very accomplished NBA head coach who won a championship less than 3 years ago with this team, and hire a college coach who I think people respect what Kelvin Sampson did in his time with the Bucks and Rockets. And I think he could have stayed on that career track if he had wanted to, if he didn't have a calling to kind of go back to college and do what he's done at the University of Houston. But it would be surprising to me after all that, you know, you get rid of Mike Budenholzer to hire a guy with a grand total of 5 or 6 years of NBA assistant experience who has never been, other than I think a brief stint as the Rockets interim, a head coach at that level. It would be surprising to me. And I'm not just because I'm a Cougar fan who wants to talk himself into Kelvin Sampson not leaving the program to be an NBA head coach and to stay here for as long as he wants to for it to be his last job. But I don't know. To me, it made the version of events where he's visiting with a GM who he has an existing relationship with, and the GM is picking his brain about, you know, what do you think we should do going forward, being a, I think, very good basketball mind. To me, that makes more sense than, hey, I'm going to hire nearly 70-year-old Kelvin Sampson to be the coach of this team that's going to have an immense amount of pressure on it going into the next NBA season. That's not my original reporting or anything like that. That's just my belief just reading the last several hours of events here.
Yeah, given where Kelvin is in his career, it's hard to imagine him leaving U of H for another college job. But kind of like I said, I think the thing that makes a little bit of sense is if there's an NBA job that comes calling where it's like, hey, in the next 5 years, you could win an NBA title and like add that to your already, you know, basketball Hall of Fame career. Milwaukee's that kind of job. You could go to Milwaukee and for the next 5 years, Kelvin Sampson could. He might win, you know, an NBA title because I think he's that good of a coach and there clearly seems to be that much talent on the roster there. So, you know, but the question is, you know, and I said this earlier on Twitter is like, if in terms of the CV that you could have as a, you know, never time NBA head coach, you know, I think Kelvin Sampson, what he's done in college and what he's done as an NBA assistant, that puts him in the front of the line of the coaches who have never coached in the NBA before. But if you're a team that has a talent to go win an NBA title, then you might not want to go with the coach that's never coached as a head coach in the NBA before. So that kind of is the catch-22 that makes you think that maybe with this job in specific and with, you know, other NBA jobs more generally, that maybe there is a decent chance. Like I said, well, I would still probably lean towards Kelvin Sampson, excuse me, will most likely retire from the University of Houston.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I want to also say I agree with what you said earlier that if he does decide either, you know, one, to take the Bucks job or two, retire in the next season or two, that I feel as strongly as you do that the program would be in good hands with Kelvin Sampson, who has had a very, very hands-on role in building this program with his dad into what it was. I think it's unfair to expect him to be every bit the X's and O's coach's dad is, because his dad might be the best X's and O's coach of this generation of college basketball guys, but I think he's proven himself to be a damn good coach in his own right, and somebody who's as intimately familiar as anybody other than Kelvin at what's gone into the last 9-10 years of building Cougar men's basketball.
I was going to say, I think we've seen him, especially early in the early years, do a really good job being the lead recruiter on identifying some guys that were a little bit under the radar and came to the program. We've seen him be the lead recruiter on some high-profile guys more recently that have come in and be part of the program. And we've seen him, you know, be the lead coach, lead assistant for coaching the big men and how much you know, improvement we've seen from the big men consistently in this program. So it's certainly, again, it's kind of the same thing. Kelvin Sampson, I think, comes in with about as good of a CV as you can ask for from a, you know, never time college head coach until of course whenever his dad leaves and he takes over. So feels very good, like we're gonna have someone with the last name of Sampson running the Cougar basketball program for quite a while, and makes me feel pretty excited about where we're going.
No doubt.
All right, then we did want to talk about the first of the three teams that were still in season. This one we can use in the past tense because their season ended just earlier today, as we're recording this on Wednesday evening here, the 17th, and that is the Cougar men's golf program, who took 11th place at NCAA regionals. And we talked about, you know, kind of in the preview how, you know, for Houston to really put a scare into some teams, they're going to kind of have everyone need to bring their A game all at once. And it just didn't really happen in a pretty tough competitive regional. We saw Santiago de la Fuente and Braxton Watkins co-lead Houston at 8 over par, putting them in a tie for 36th on the individual leaderboard. And you kind of saw where, you know, like de la Fuente kind of started slow and then was playing a little bit better by the final round. And Watkins kind of started pretty strong, but kind of tailed off towards the end. Austin Riley, another Cougar that, you know, had a nice first round and kind of tailed off. So just didn't get that kind of everybody coming together at once and bringing their A game situation that the Cougs needed. And like I said, kind of what we knew going in as a 9 seed with the top 5 teams advancing, knew that that getting to the NCAA championships was going to be a tall order. But you know, in fact, went in the other direction by a couple spots, finished a couple spots below their seed. But you know, nonetheless, I think a season that ends here and gave you some excitement with the conference championship, but. You know, even with not a lot of expectations going into the NCAA championships, it was a bit of ending with a whimper.
Yeah, I think my hope going into this regional, I think it was a realistic hope, something like what the women's team did last week at their regional in Pullman. And the Cougars didn't do terribly per se, but I would say unlike the women's regional, there wasn't really a point after the team started playing on Monday that I thought U of H was ever in a realistic place to make a push for the top 5 in the team score. And we kind of knew that the team would rise and fall with Santiago de la Fuente, who's been excellent this season, but just unfortunately didn't have his best 3 days in Auburn. I thought he had a decent final round today, unfortunately, on a day where none of his teammates seemed to be playing anything close to their best golf. And not to make this about one golfer, but, you know, if de la Fuente has a stronger first couple days, I don't know, maybe you're closer to striking distance of that group of Indiana, Ohio State, and Colorado State, who were kind of generally around the final qualifying places for much of the event. Cougs finished today 11 over, 11th out of 13 for the team score. And mentioned it, but Dale Fuente had a really solid 2-under par final round, ended up tying with his teammate Braxton Watkins. Both were 8 over par for the 3-day event, tied for 36th, each of them on the individual leaderboard. So I wouldn't say wildly disappointing. I don't think any season that ends in a conference title and regional appearance is ever anything close to disappointment ever, but it does feel like the program has maybe plateaued a bit. Not like in a position where anyone should lose their job or should talk about anyone losing their job, but I also don't think it's out of line to say that maybe this team should have been a bit more competitive in 30-something strokes off the lead in this regional. I mean, you saw a team ranked around where U of H was in Chattanooga ultimately fall off at the end, but be very much in the top couple spots there for a lot of this regional. And the Cougars were closer to the cellar dwellers, Augusta and Siena, than they were Auburn in first place. So not exactly what you want there, but I wouldn't call it, I wouldn't go as far as to call it disappointing.
Yeah, it's not the worst season. It's a season where you advance to NCAA postseason and when you win a conference title, certainly, like I said, there's a lot to be happy about with the season. But kind of like you said, it seems like a program that has kind of plateaued. And not even speaking in a historical perspective from being the, you know, national championship winningest program in NCAA Division I men's golf history, but also, you know, just even from more recent years under Jonathan Dismuke, his early years here when the program was playing at more of a top 25 to 30 kind of level than where they're at the moment. But so yeah, I think it's a program that going into the Big 12, it's going to be interesting to see what happens there, if that is able to provide a boost for the program and kind of kick it up a notch, or if that kind of puts Houston in a conference where every time they go to the conference meet, you know, so because there's a lot of really, really good, you know, the Oklahoma States and some really, really good teams in the Big 12. So if you're going to your conference meet, it just, you know, this is going to be Houston's last conference championship for a very, very long time, unless something fairly significant changes from where the level that the program has been at for the last several years here now. So interesting to see where this program is. I know I say that for every sport, but it's true with every sport, I guess. But I'm very interested to see what happens with the transition to the Big 12.
Yeah, in terms of incoming players, real quick here, Dismuke is bringing in a couple freshmen. The guy who I think is the most likely immediate contributor is a Taiwanese junior golfer. He'll be coming in as a freshman. Chichun Chen had a really promising junior career. And Dismuke's pretty consistently brought in college transfers the last few seasons, so we'll probably see at least one new golfer from the college ranks coming to the program who's going to be pushing to be a regular in that tournament 5. So again, big picture, certainly not going to say any season that ends the way this one did is a disappointment, but like you said, it's about to get a whole lot tougher with the men's golf competition that's going to be in the Cougars' new league.
All right, and then Cougar Track and Field just took part at AAC Championships this past week. Both the men's and the women's teams would end up taking second place at AAC Championships, so no conference hardware of any sort coming home to the Cougar Track and Field program this year in their final season in the American. Definitely a disappointment, especially, you know, I think, you know, on the women's side, we kind of knew going in that that the women were going to struggle against a UCF team that is just much much deeper than anybody else in the American. And when we kind of knew it was going to win by a landslide and did, in fact, win by a landslide. But for the Cougar men, it was just a really annoying feeling of deja vu because, you know, for the second straight year, watching the outdoor title kind of slip through their fingers to Wichita State for the second year in a row. And it looks like Houston was going to get that redemption with two events left. They were in the lead, and, you know, and the final event is the 4x4 relay, which Houston was the favorite to win. But that intervening event was the 5K, and not only did Houston not have anyone that could score in the 5K, Wichita State got several points from I think it was like three athletes that all kind of outperformed their seed times and got them a bunch of points, which put them enough in front of Houston going into the final event that even if Houston won the 4x4, which they did end up doing to close the conference meet, all that Wichita had to do was finish fourth or better to claim the title outright. They finished third, and by two freaking points are the back-to-back AAC outdoor track and field champions. So, Sam, I know we had a lot of exciting men's performances to talk about, and we're going to talk about a lot of individual champions who had a lot of individual events, but certainly I think, you know, worth just talking about the fact that it's 2 years in a row now where, you know, we've seen the Cougs not able to bring the outdoor title, didn't bring in the indoor title this year either. So it's kind of another program where it's like, oh yeah, you've kind of taken a step back, you know, from where you had been in recent years, and your level of competition is about to go way up heading into the Big 12. So another program that, you know, I think kind of, again, I guess we should be talking to them in the post because they still do have NCAA championships to get to. So we don't want to entirely do the postmortem of the season yet, but definitely was like a little bit of a disappointment, or I would say not even a little bit. It was a lot of a disappointment watching Wichita sneak just by the Cougars again.
Yeah, if you want to go back further, this is now the third time in the last four AAC outdoor championships going back to the 2019 championship where the Cougars and Wichita State were the top two teams, and this one finished by an extremely close margin. You had that 2019 championship with the Cougars, won an extremely close one, and unfortunately, yeah, for the second year in a row, you saw the Cougars come up short by a pretty narrow margin for the men's team championship. And like you said, I think the Cougar women did basically what we hoped for. UCF was going to be very, very tough. They finished second behind the Knights. They picked up their first individual event win since the 2021 outdoor. So I think feel pretty good about that. I think the Cougar women did exactly what we were hoping from them. Even on some individual athletes, when I was kind of reviewing the performances, like, oh yeah, not to get ahead of ourselves, Cecilia Tamayo Garza did a good job being the best non-UCF sprinter in those two events. I think we'll get to here talk about the women. Cecilia Tamayo Garza finished second in an event where her and the winner broke the AAC outdoor record. I think that tells you just the kind of meet she had. I think the depth too in the women's side, and I think go to the men's side a bit there. I think some of that, I don't think we're lacking the top end performers. There's a number of men's athletes we're going to talk about that had really good championships, but it's no longer a situation like, to go back to how the 100 used to be in the men's side, where you look, 68 places were occupied by Cougar sprinters in that final, and you still have a legit stud, one of the very best sprinters out there in Sean Masuanyani, but now you don't have 3 to 5 guys behind him who you can just expect to reliably hoover up all the points in that event. But talking about the Cougar women for a sec here, Dustin, the throw squad represented Nuuasala Tuilafano officially got the Cougars that first event win since the 2021 outdoors, took the shot put with a best throw of 52 feet, 3¾ inches. She's second at the last year AAC outdoors. Daisy Mone and Haley Pollard also both picked up points behind her. Pollard got her first career outdoor championship podium with third in the discus, teammate Daisy Mone just behind her. And fourth, Priscilla Dejacun on the podium, third in the hammer throw. And Cecilia Tamayo Garza, like I mentioned, being the best of the rest behind Rainia Jones and Latasha Smith in the 100 and 200, respectively. Had a really good meet. And Sydney Townsend finishing second in the 400 hurdles, beating the previous AAC outdoor record winner like Tamayo Garza did in the 200. And no biggie, just the fastest time in Cougar program history as well, which I thought was pretty cool. Second in the relays behind UCF and USF, respectively, in the 4x1 and 4x4. As well, so I think even though you were a good bit behind the first place team, I think realistically as good as you could have expected to do on the women's side, and I think we could be happy about that.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of a little bit funny that Tamayo Garza really finished second place in four events, the 100, the 200, the 4x1, and the 4x4, because she was on both Cougar relays.
That's right, yeah.
So she finished second place to UCF in all four events, which is an awfully impressive weekend to be, you know, on the podium four times, although I'm sure maybe she would have loved to get the gold on like one of them, but nonetheless, extremely impressive performance. You mentioned Townsend with that razor-thin second place in the 400 hurdles. Not only was it a personal best and a school record, like you mentioned, but it broke a school mark that had stood for 32 years. It broke that mark by nearly a full second. Not only that, the athlete whose school record she broke is none other than her current assistant coach, Sandra Glover, which is pretty cool. And then, yeah, Haley Pollard had, you mentioned getting her first conference title as a senior, had never broken 50 meters in the discus previously, did it twice, including that best throw of 51.62 meters, over 169 feet, getting that first career podium finish in third place. So really excited, you know, thought it was some strong performances for the women. Definitely, you know, Townsend now in, I think, eighth fastest in the 400 hurdles, one of, you know, a handful of Cougs that I think are going to have a chance to make some noise heading to prelims. But all in all, I think, like you said, as good of a performance as you could have hoped for on the women's side. And then, you know, on the men's side, like I said, there were definitely some performances that would deserve to be celebrated. You know, no surprise that Sean Maswangani led the charge, doing the double, both going under 10 seconds in the 100 meters, and for the first time in his career, going under 20 seconds in the 200 meters. Remarkable, remarkable feats to win both events. Both are his best marks of the year. Both are top five times nationally. Both events are ones that he is a legitimate national title threat. And also anchored Houston to win the 4x1 relay, which is also an event that Houston has a chance to make noise in come nationals. For sure, no surprise, Christian Sampi won the pole vault, heads to nationals as one of the top 10 vaulters in the country. And then one of the events where, you know, Houston had one of their best events was kind of a surprising one. It was not a traditional Cougar strength, but Lloyd Frilo and Adam Mason went 1-2 in the 800 meters to get the Cougars 18 points there. The Cougars also went 1-2 in the 110 hurdles with Devian Wilson taking gold, silver going to DJ Akindele. And really, you know, I think Townsend on the women's side and Wilson on the men's side give Houston two really exciting hurdlers with eligibility left as Houston heads to the Big 12 next year. Cougs also taking a bunch of team points in the long jump, taking third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh place, respectively. So like I said, definitely some things to like there. But, you know, I think in terms of, you know, what the reasons Houston didn't make didn't get over the hump and get that team title was, you know, I think triple jump kind of had a disappointing event for multiple athletes there. And then, you know, just I think the thing that was also kind of striking to me was seeing Houston only getting 4 points from one single athlete finishing in fifth place in all four of the men's throwing events combined. And just as the Houston women are kind of entering their era of throwing excellence over the last few years, we've seen the men who never been a throwing specialist program, but who've had some good throwers, you know, decline to the point of, you know, like I said, barely being able to score points at conference, let alone worrying about nationals. So, you know, if you're going to kind of basically pass on throwing and distance running events, you better, you know, kind of kick all kinds of ass in, you know, the sprints, the hurdles, and the jumps. And Houston did well in those events, but kind of like you mentioned, they just didn't kick ass at a large enough scale to make up for their deficiencies elsewhere. They didn't have the five or six or seven guys, you know, in the finals of the men's sprinting events. They had three, including Sean, in each event, and the two other guys in both events didn't finish on the podium. So just not the same kind of dominance that you used to see. In the 400, an event where Houston has had some absolute studs, has had its national title winner in Kamari Montgomery, you know, nobody finished higher than fifth in conference play. So definitely some questions to be answered. And another program, like I said, we're definitely hoping to see the Big 12 affiliation, I think, kind of kick things up a notch.
Yeah, I think I had that in my notes too. I think your biggest missed opportunity was the two jumps, that you only got one combined podium performance for the long and triple jump. Not the best for men's throwing either, but I would say at least I don't think you and I really expected a whole lot from the men's throws, which does beg the question. Yeah, it's like, hey, what happened to when you were, you used to have like Tristan Gibbons, I think is the first name that comes to mind. You had guys that could at least get points at the conference meet level, and that's just not where you are with those athletes right now. But I would say you didn't really have podium or championship winning expectations going into the weekend, which maybe you did for the jumps. Wanted to add, I mean, then how much more can you add about the incredible weekend Sean Massagnani had, winning the 100, 200, running a sub 10 in the 100, a sub 22nd 200. I thought it was really cool, Dustin. Picked up 4 points in the long jump finals, an event that, I mean, Carl Lewis has raved to us about Sean's potential in it, but not one he can always participate in. I thought just really cool that he could contribute as much as he did in those two sprint events and also give the team 4 points in an event that he has some proficiency in, but isn't maybe always able to participate in. So yeah, I think you're not lacking the top end athletes that we've seen this program have for the history of our podcast and obviously years prior to that, but you maybe don't have the depth in some of those premium events, and you're not getting picked up on maybe the distance or some of the field side as much as you would like, or maybe as much as you were 4 or 5 years ago.
So next up for the Cougars, as we kind of alluded to, is NCAA prelims, which start next Wednesday, the 24th, and then run through that Saturday before Memorial Day. Unlike NCAA indoors, where they just take the top 16 athletes in each event, for outdoors you have prelims, where lots of athletes qualify for prelims. There's East and West prelims. Houston will compete in the West prelims in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Each individual event we'll get the top 48 qualified athletes from that side of the country in each event, and then the two relay events will each take the top 24 schools from their region, and then in each event you'll have the top 12 qualify from each regional, making it 24 total entrants in each event that make it to outdoor nationals. And we've, you know, seen a number of times where athletes that you maybe expect to qualify don't, or athletes that you don't expect to qualify do. So it is always kind of a little bit of a guessing game when looking at who might qualify. But just in terms of where the current national rankings stand for the athletes that you think have the best chances to go, certainly, like we talked about in the sprinting events, it's Sean in the 100 and the 200. It's Cecilia Tamayo Garza in the 100 and the 200 as well. You know, Edward Sumler has shown the sprinting ability in the past, but has struggled this year. Maybe he's a dark horse to kind of figure it out in Fayetteville and kind of get it going. You know, Devion Wilson, DJ Akindele, both in the top 24 nationally in the 110 hurdles. Townsend, like we mentioned, top 10 in the 400 hurdles. Destiny Smith, not top 24 in the 100 hurdles, but close enough to have a shot. Fryloa, you know, I think in the 800, he's only 47th nationally, but he's peaking at the right time. Maybe he goes from an event in the AAC championships where he was kind of leading the pack and setting the pace to one where he's going to, you know, kind of be pushed by other top athletes. Maybe he is able to peak even a little bit more. So maybe another dark horse there. Certainly, the 4x1 relays for both the men and the women have a chance to qualify for nationals. Christian Stamping, the pole vault, Priscilla Adejikun in the hammer throw, probably Houston's best chance to get someone from the throw squad to nationals. So, you know, lots of potential qualifiers out there, so it's going to be just a ton of events to keep an eye on throughout West prelims. But hopefully, we're going to see a strong contingent of several Cougs heading to outdoor nationals. Sam,
yeah, I think what always excites me is who's the surprise athlete. I think I can't remember exactly which outdoor, but Benjamin Okafor, I think, surprisingly qualified in the long jump at West prelims of the years past. So kind of interested who this year's Okafor is going to be. And I think Freelo, who you talked about a decent amount there, is a good candidate there. Certainly seems to be doing his best here down the stretch of the season.
To be clear, one of the people that could be this year's Okafor
is Benjamin Okafor.
Would be Okafor.
Exactly.
Yeah, because he's still on the roster. He could still do it in the long jump. But we'll
I know. But it would be very funny if Benjamin Okafor was this year's Benjamin Okafor, I grant.
All right. And then in terms of the other in-season sport, did want to talk about some Cougar baseball, who swept Tulane to remain in first place by half a game in the American Athletic Conference. That was funny. I said last week, I said I was worried that with Houston seemingly taking 2 out of 3 every weekend and Tulane taking 1 out of 3 every weekend, it almost made too much sense that, you know, the trends wouldn't continue and maybe Tulane would sneak and get the series. Or, you know, I did mention that even if the trends did hold, that, you know, ECU could easily sweep Memphis and overtake Houston for first place in the American. But oh, me of little faith, you know, I was right in the sense that ECU did sweep, but Houston turned around and did the same thing, taking all three from Tulane, a couple in a fairly dramatic fashion, and stayed half a game up in the American heading into the final weekend of the regular season coming up here. And Houston opened the weekend with kind of the least dramatic game of the weekend. They jumped out to a 9-0 lead after four innings on Friday, and some Cougar pitching wildness led to Tulane putting up a three spot in the bottom of the fifth, but that was all the scoring either team did. Houston ends up with the relatively undramatic 6-run win. Cougs got 2-run homers from Zach Arnold and Justin Murray to lead the way. And Sam, that one was relatively calm, but the rest of the weekend was about to get a little bit crazy. Am I right?
Yeah, never a bad thing, by the way, when you're leading 2-0 after your second batter finishes, like Zach Earl did when he blasted a 2-run homer to lead off this game. And I guess if you're going to have a time where your pitching combines for 7 walks and 2 innings, I guess better to do it when you're up 9-0 than any other situation. But really picking nits about what was the least dramatic win. In Saturday's game, kind of followed the opposite script of that Friday win. Tulane got out to an early lead with a 4-spot in the second inning. And I think you tweeted this in real time, Dustin. It felt like Cougar starter, and I agree with your assessment, Grayson Dressick got squeezed on a couple of 2-strike pitches and the at-bat where Tulane's Brady Ebert ended up hitting a bases-clearing double. Certainly, we would see the baseball gods look kindly on the Cougars at different points in the remainder of this game in the series, but that inning was just a reminder of how fine the line can be sometimes between a clean outing and not for your pitchers. Kyle Ayers, for the second week in a row, came on in a Saturday game and gave the Cougars some really strong innings in relief. Other than the occasional wildness and some walks, he did a really good job silencing the Green Wave bats, kept the Green Wave from extending their lead any further, and you saw the bats finally break through a bit in the fifth inning. E. McMillan socked his 6th home run of the year, cut the Green Wave lead to 4-2, and Tulane starter Ricky Castro, he got to tip his cap to him, really seemed to be coming into his own in the weekends prior to this one against ECU and UCF previously, and should be noted, did a good job keeping the Cougar hitters in check other than that McMillan home run. Braden Forsyth came on, relieved Ayers in the seventh inning, worked around runners on second and third with no outs, struck out the final 3 hitters of the inning, and that third and final strikeout, Dustin, I don't know if you were watching this one live, came with a bit of controversy. The home plate umpire, and with 2 strikes, called Tulane's hitter at the time, Gavin Schultz, out for, I guess you'd call it a delay for not being up and ready to go in the batter's box in the appropriate amount of time. I did some research. As I understand it, pitchers have 20 seconds to begin their delivery or a ball gets called, and hitters have to be in the batter's box within 10 seconds, and they can't step out after 10 seconds. I didn't do the full Zapruder film style breakdown that I may or may not have been mad enough to do if this had been U of H on the receiving end, but Tulane's coach Jay Uhlman was mad enough about it that 14 to 15 hours later, he got ejected from before Sunday's game because he was still arguing that call. But no doubt a really critical juncture of this game, maybe where the baseball gods smiled on the Cougars a bit, and the Cougars were able to keep the deficit at 4-2 going into that eighth inning. Cougars would immediately respond in the top half of that inning with Justin Murray, who else, getting the scoring started with an RBI single, plates Zach Arnold. Murray would later score on a wild pitch. And after a scoreless bottom of the eighth by, you guessed it, Justin Murray, who had that RBI in the previous inning, the Cougars get things going in the ninth with a Zach Lopez leadoff walk. Alex Lopez, Zach Arnold reaches on a pretty obvious catcher's interference. Lopez eventually gets home on a Cameron Nickens sack fly. Thankfully, Justin Murray has a 1-2-3 ninth. After that, Cougs steal a 5-4 win on Saturday in Uptown.
I was going to say, in addition to tweeting about feeling like the Cougs were getting pinched in the zone, also tweeted after not only the bases clearing double that happened after the couple of pretty good looking 2-strike, 2-out pitches, the bases clearing double that then was followed up on the next pitch by an infield single and scored the runner from second base. And it was just like all of a sudden you went from like, I feel like we're going to get out of this inning to we're down 4-0. Maybe things are not going our way. I even kind of tweeted, maybe things are not going to go Houston's way today. But really impressed by the effort to kind of steal one that felt like it was going to go the other way for a significant portion of the game. And then on Sunday, we got a good old-fashioned slugfest. The first inning was actually the only inning in which neither team scored. Houston fell behind 1-0, went up 4-1, fell behind 8-5, went up 11-8, let Tulane pull within 12-11 heading into the ninth, and then mercifully Houston put up a 5 spot in the top of the ninth, capped off by a Cam Nickens 2-run triple to provide some insurance runs, ends up winning 17-11 for the sweep. Houston puts up 17 runs on 13 hits without the benefit of a home run. Cam Nickens, Justin Murray driving in 4 runs apiece. Murray also got the last 7 outs on the mound for his 9th save of the season, capping off just a frankly insane two-way weekend. One of the just one great one-man Cougar baseball performances we've seen over a weekend series in recent memory. In addition, Brandon Use, Zach Arnold, Ian McMillan, Drew Bianco all scored 3 times in the 17 run. It was a very, very football scorey type of game. And as much as, you know, Houston's pitching was genuinely giving up too many free base runners in this one, as evidenced by Tulane's 11 runs, the Cougars did them even better on the other end. Got 11 free base runners on 7 walks, 3 hit by pitches. And for the second consecutive game, a catcher's interference with Zach Arnold at the plate, weirdly enough. But, you know, ultimately just really excited to see the Cougars not only get the win, but like I said, get the sweep, and a sweep that they knew that they needed, because the ECU game, I believe, had gone final before that Sunday game even started. So I remember, you know, we kind of knew going in, hey, you need to get that first 3-game sweep of the year to hold on to that that narrow half-game lead, and did exactly what they needed to do, Sam.
Yeah, by the way, rewinding a bit, I'm remiss in not mentioning Justin Murray's absurd Saturday line. A perfect 4-of-4 at the plate, stole 3 bases, also reached on a hit by pitch, and had 2 scoreless hitless innings to finish off the game for the win. Just an absolutely absurd stat there. Also, another very different...
After hitting that 2-run home run Friday.
After hitting the 2-run home run Friday.
And then ridiculous.
Also, 12 pitchers took the mound on Sunday between the two teams. Every single one of them allowed at least 1 run. So, didn't have the weather report almost going in New Orleans, but certainly seemed like friendly offensive conditions. Really felt like a classic college baseball pitching optional Sunday finale to a weekend series.
Yeah, I think you got to say, you know, heading down the home stretch here, this is a Cougar baseball program that looked like it was in a pretty rough place heading into AAC play this year. I remember saying, kind of only really half meaning it, that, you know, hey, you're opening with ECU, the one good team of the conference, you get them at home, you know, hey, maybe you somehow win 2 out of 3 here, and all of a sudden you have a chance to set a new tone for your season, and Houston did exactly that. They've won all 7 of their AAC series up until this point. They've won 6 conference games in a row to move to 15-5 on the year, half a game up on a legitimately good Pirate team heading into the last weekend series of the year. So I think you just have to say what a turnaround it's been. I think this last weekend was the most fun I've had watching Cougar baseball, and this is broadly the best I felt about the program since the 2018 team, the last one that went to a regional, the last one that the won an AAC title of any kind. So excited to see what this Cougar team does down the stretch.
Yeah, it's a reminder of how fun it is to follow a good college baseball team down the stretch of the season, because it just hasn't really consistently happened since that 2018 season. And I think we weren't wrong to not maybe have a ton of faith after a 5-11 start to the season, but boy, this lineup looks to be everything advertised and then some, and the pitching's been a little difficult, but I think that still does also come with the context that you have a lot of the key guys who you thought would be starter or reliever contributors on this staff not available because of health. Kyle Calamedo, haven't seen him since the very beginning of his second start of the year, done for the year. Jose Torrealba, who was your best reliever down the stretch last year's, missed most of the season. Paul Schultz, who had been really strong, had looked like a mainstay of your weekend rotation, now is, I don't think it's out for the season, but is being rested until at least the conference tournament, has missed a decent amount of time because of his injury. So I think it's been a delight to watch a team that looks like it knows what's doing, and that this lineup just full of guys who can absolutely mash. I think it's been a delight.
Yeah, so Houston's Tuesday game against Sam Houston State, the rubber match in the Don Sanders Cup, was unfortunately canceled due to inclement weather, so that one will have to go. This cup will have to go down as a draw this year, but since Houston swept the Don Sanders Cup last year, I'm going to go ahead and say the title stays with the Cougars, and then the Cougs will
come and
host
take
Cincinnati.
It, Sam Houston.
That's exactly correct. The Cougs will close out hosting Cincinnati this Thursday through Saturday. Cougs hosting the 9-12 Bearcats, while ECU travels to Tampa to take on 7-14 USF. So I think, you know, maybe fairly even difficulty levels for each team, given that the, you know, Houston gets to be at home, but again, maybe a slightly better team. Which is to say that Houston might need to sweep this weekend series again to get the program's first conference title in 5 years, given the way that ECU is also playing right now. And you know, I think fairly similarly to Tulane last weekend, this is a Cincinnati team that doesn't hit for great average, but they do have a good amount of pop. And then pitching wise, they've just they've struggled mightily. Even the Greenies had a couple of guys at least with sub 5 ERAs. Cincinnati has nobody on their roster with a sub 5 ERA. They've given up 20 plus runs over the weekend to every team in the American except Memphis, who they opened their conference campaign with. So Houston might need a weekend sweep, Sam, but you know, I'm not sure that I would bet against them doing that, just because this is a Houston team that's playing awfully well right now, and a Cincinnati team that doesn't look like the strongest, but going to be a lot on the line for sure.
Absolutely, and it really feels like for the last several seasons that the Bearcat baseball team has occupied kind of that same general spot in the league standings, not at the top, not at the bottom, kind of in a space as a pesky middle or lower middle part of the standings team. This was last year a 500 team in conference play, just behind the 2022 version of the Cougars, but they did lose off of that team a key hitter, Griffin Merritt, who transferred to Tennessee, is actually currently leading the Vols in home runs. One of their top pitchers from last year, Connor Lynn, has missed nearly all of this season injured. Right now, Cincy's just ahead of USF with a third worst RPI in the conference. And when I got to actually kind of dig into their season numbers on both the hitting and pitching side of things, it's kind of surprising that they're even 9-12 in AAC play. I mean, other than Josh Hegeman, no regularly appearing Bearcat hitter is hitting over 300, and Hegeman is definitely not hitting over 300 with anything in the way of power. Ryan Nicholson is having a good year, and the Bearcats do hit pretty well for power. Nicholson has 12 home runs and a pretty healthy OPS, and I think part of that also, you have to say, some context, is the fact that since he plays in a home stadium that is pretty offense friendly, but I would say also kind of counterbalancing that, as a cold weather team, they do play away from home enough that maybe that's not 100% of the cause. Something to note also, the Cougars will be facing an opponent that is as aggressive as them on the base pass for the first time in a while. The Bearcats coming into this week had swiped 93 bags. Maybe in some part that aggression on the base path explains the Bearcats' ability to create as much offense as they had, not hitting for great average and hitting for good, but not exceptional power. Six different Bearcat regulars have at least 8 stolen bases coming in to this week, and I don't know if I could say really anything positive about their pitching staff, because Tulane at least had Ricky Castro, who showed himself in last Saturday's game to be a pretty good starting pitcher. Like you said, literally nobody, even limited appearance guys, there's not a single guy on the roster who has an ERA below 5, and the two lowest ERA guys in their staff, Chase Horst and Dylan Broski, neither of those guys have been regular starting pitchers. Neither of them, to wit, started in any of last weekend's series games against UCF. They don't have great strikeout numbers like the Cougar staff, maybe walk a bit more than is ideal. I will say, and unlike the Cougar staff, who has at least a few guys pitching better than their season numbers might indicate, I don't think UC is trending in a great direction. This is a team that has, to this point, 9 games against the other top teams in the AAC. We'll say for purposes of this, ECU and Wichita State, they are 1-8 against those two teams, with the one win coming at home against Wichita. Their only conference series wins have come against USF, Tulane, and Memphis, with Tulane and Memphis being a series in Cincy. We'll note, ECU has been the only team to sweep Cincy in conference play, and that, I agree with you, Dustin, is what the Cougars will need to do to guarantee themselves a conference regular season title and feel comfortable with ECU playing a not-so-great USF team. We'll say, Dustin, about that South Florida series, not to give us hope, which hope can be the most dangerous thing sometimes, but and you'd obviously prefer if ECU was closing their regular season against Wichita State or somebody not tied for last place in the conference standings, but the Pirates have been weirdly bad away from home. They're 9-10 this year in away or neutral site games as compared to how they've looked in Greenville, which has been pretty unbeatable, and USF was able to just take one game off Wichita State on the road last weekend, but oh man, Dustin, just one USF win would just take so much pressure off. Come on, Bulls.
Yeah, get one. If all you got to do is beat Cincinnati 2 out of 3 for the title, then, you know, at that point, if you don't do it, you can genuinely say, like, okay, well, we fumbled the ball on that one.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Yeah, to not have the sweep, to not have that be the height would be awfully nice. Either way, the Cougs afterwards will be heading to Clearwater for AAC Championships starting next Tuesday, I believe, already. The conference only has 8 teams, so everybody qualifies, and what you have is 2 concurrent double elimination tournaments happening, one with the 1, 4, 5, and 8 seeds, and one with the 2, 3, 6, and 7 seeds. Excuse me. And then the winners of both of those double eliminations will face each other on the Sunday of Memorial Day weekend at 11 a.m. Central on ESPN News for the conference title in a single one winner-take-all game. There are, obviously, kind of like we mentioned, 3 teams that have looked much better than everybody else all conference long in Houston, ECU, and Wichita. So obviously winning the conference regular season title would also mean not having to face the Pirates or the Shockers until theoretically the championship game, which would be a very nice plus bonus in addition to the main prize of, you know, winning a conference regular season title. But, you know, given that, you know, Houston's impressive conference run has only improved their RPI to, I believe, 93 at last check as of this evening, they're going to need that AAC title if they want to keep their season going into the NCAA postseason. So, you know, no pressure this weekend, anything against Cincinnati or next week in Clearwater. But like I said, glad we have a Cougar team that is at least peaking at the right time that gives you the chance to think that, hey, they're going to go give a good account of themselves, not only on senior weekend this weekend against the Bearcats, but next week in Clearwater as well.
Yeah, I think you have to be encouraged as a Cougar fan, knock on wood, I guess, with one series left to play, but that this Cougar team has not lost 2 games in a row to anybody in conference, given that up until at least the championship, this is a, you know, lose 2 to potentially go home kind of situation. And that, I know 2019 and 2021 were the opposite, but this is a team under Todd Whitting that has generally done quite well in Clearwater. The good runs through the tournament, including last year where the Cougars got 1 game away and ultimately lost to an ECU team that looked head and shoulders above the conference. Also, encouraging, as good as the Pirates are playing, that, and this is still a good ECU team that will go into this conference tournament really just playing for seeding, not for any kind of, I think, doubt for their at-large postseason resume, but maybe not an ECU team that is as much of an unbeatable force as last year's group was, to where even if you had the run that the Cougars did, you felt like you were just kind of delaying the inevitable. And I think the Cougars taking 2 or 3 doesn't guarantee that you could dispatch the Pirates in the postseason, but maybe it makes them feel and look a little bit less invincible to this group of guys who, up until the series earlier this season, many of them never had seen the Cougars get a head-to-head win against this Pirates team. So excited to see it. Excited for one last season, Dustin, to wake up absurdly early in the morning and watch games on the American Digital Network in beautiful Clearwater, Florida.
Powered, no doubt, by solar power every hour.
I'm going to be humming the jingle to myself on Tuesday morning, looking forward to some postseason baseball.
Real AAC baseball heads know what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
All right, getting to some offseason Cougar news. Cougar football added Tony Mathis Jr., running back from the University of West Virginia. I believe it's West Virginia University. I hate when people get that wrong. That's my bad. West Virginia University, I assume, since their WVU is there. Their acronym. But, you know, Mathis kind of a platoon guy the last couple of years for them. Looks like maybe kind of a more of a between the tackles runner, but with McCaskill gone, kind of like we talked about, you know, you would like to have a little bit more depth, you know, maybe a third guy to kind of carry the load alongside, you know, Snead and Campbell. And I think Mathis gives you that. He's a guy that you wouldn't, you know, don't expect him to go out there and be your feature back, but certainly be part of kind of a three-back rotation for Dana Holgorsen.
And saying Mathis is a complete like-for-like replacement without McCaskill, I don't think it's fair to McCaskill, because McCaskill's one healthy season, I would say, is probably better than Mathis' last 2. But you're bringing in a veteran guy with Big 12 experience who will make this team better running between the tackles than it projected to be post-McCaskill being this program. Mathis Jr. played the last 4 years at West Virginia, redshirted in 2019, having that season of free eligibility in 2020 as well. So he'll come to the Cougars as a grad transfer with 2 years of eligibility left, got the most of his on-field action in the last 2 seasons, as I mentioned, including a career-high and team-high 562 rushing yards this past season. Far and away, Mathis' best game was a nationally televised win over Baylor, where he rushed for 163 yards at the time Baylor was ranked, and it was a decent upset. Looking back on it, I was like, okay, well, a 5-7 West Virginia team beat whatever, a 6 or 7 win Baylor team at the time, looked like a pretty big win for the Mountaineers. Last season, kind of like you mentioned, Mathis platooned a fair bit with CJ Donaldson, but I think not unfair to Mathis to say Donaldson was maybe a tiny bit more effective over the course of last season. And there's a tie to the staff, because even though he never played for Dana Holgorsen at West Virginia, the timing alone that he signed in December of 2018 would tell you he was recruited by the Holgorsen staff. And even when I dug further and looked at his recruiting profile, his primary recruiter was Doug Belk, and his secondary was former Cougar assistant Markel Blackwell in that initial recruitment. So won't drastically change anyone's outlook on the prospects of the 2023 Cougar offense, but makes you a bit better at position group that you are a bit weaker for the loss of McCaskill at.
All right, then some other offseason news. Offseason news that I think, Sam, maybe got both of us a little bit more excited than we expected was the Big 12 this past week releasing the 2023 conference schedules for both soccer and volleyball. And one of my top line news that I really like is I think it's kind of nice that it worked out such that Houston's first three Big 12 contests will be in three different sports. So if you want to start the countdown clock to that first Houston Big 12 conference game, it's less than 4 months from now. That first date is Thursday, September 14th, when Cougar Soccer will travel to Lubbock to take on Texas Tech. 2 days after that, of course, Cougar Football will host TCU. And then the following Wednesday, the 20th, Cougar Volleyball will be in Provo to take on BYU in their Big 12 opener. And then Cougar Soccer, as I mentioned, starts off on the road against Tech, but then they return home for their first two Big 12 home games the following Thursday, Sunday, hosting UCF and Oklahoma. They play 4 or 5 then away from home before closing out the season hosting UT Austin and Baylor October 15th and 23rd. And quick aside, the Big 12 so far is 3 of 3 in giving U of H home games against the Longhorns. Football got one, soccer got one, spoiler alert, volleyball got two. All in sports when you play home games against half or fewer of the schools in your conference, and Houston has got home games against the Longhorns in 3 out of 3. We love it. We love it very much. But then I guess my only other kind of note on the soccer schedule was that, you know, looking at scheduling difficulty, I think it's a big variable in a sport like soccer where you have 10 conference matches, but all 14 Big 12 schools sponsor women's soccer. So playing only 10 of your 13 opponents, you know, the three teams that you miss is kind of a big deal. And the three teams that Houston misses are BYU, who had the best RPI finish last year of anybody in the 2023 Big 12, as well as Oklahoma State, who would have been number 6, and then Cincinnati would have been number 8. So I think the schedulers kind of did Houston a small favor in the sense that they only play 4 of the 6 teams that finished 45th or better, while they play 6 of the 7 that finished 80th or worse. And the only lower tier team that Houston doesn't play is Cincinnati, a team that you've already faced a bunch of times in recent years. So you get to see some new faces. But I think kind of the caveat to that is you get 3 of those 4 games against your tougher opponents at home, and then 4 of the 6 against the easier opponents on the road, which may be a good thing if you're like a team gunning for a conference championship and you think you can beat the bad teams on the road. You want to have your tough matchups at home. But given that, you know, Houston played 5 matches against 2023 Big 12 teams last year, and after a 1-1 draw in the first such game, lost the next 4 by a combined score of 9-0. And given that 4 of those 5 games are against teams in that bottom tier of the conference, I think I'd rather just accept some road losses against some tough teams and then maybe try to pick up a few wins by getting some bad teams at home. Only having 2 kind of lower tier teams come visit you makes me a little bit nervous, but nobody asked me, so that's how the schedule turned out. And, you know, we'll see how Houston does in a Big 12 that, you know, soccer, I think one of the few conferences, one of the few sports, I should say, in the Big 12, where you're going to see kind of actually a decent amount of dead weight near the bottom of the conference. But like I said, we need to see some improvement over last year from Houston to not be part of that dead weight.
Yeah, it's funny. We did not share this before the show, but I had some of my notes about, and nothing you said, by the way, about how it breaks favorably Cougs is incorrect. I'm not taking issue with any of that, but in those ways that you laid out, the schedule maybe doesn't break as favorably the Cougars, that you don't get Cincy, but do get the much tougher UCF from the former AAC schools, that three of the four lowest rated RPI teams, Iowa State and the Kansas schools, are road games, that 2 of the top 3 RPI teams from last year are home games, and that you have the roadie against the conference's top team in 2022, TCU. If the Cougars can get to 3 conference wins or even 2 conference wins and at least 1 tie against the schedule, I'd actually feel really good about that. And that consider when I say that, that this team struggled enough against last year's schedule in the American that they didn't qualify for the conference tournament. It's kind of weird to unpack last year's results because the Cougars looked completely uncompetitive in losses early to Baylor and Texas Tech, and Texas Tech ended up being a fine team, but not a postseason team, and Baylor actually ended up being pretty bad, and the Cougars just really weren't competitive. The Cougars did manage a tie in the season opener at Oklahoma, but it was a game where Oklahoma definitely had the most chances, probably in the aggregate. If you looked at the advanced soccer stats, probably should have expected to win that, but this Cougar team also managed ties against two of the top three teams in the AAC, Dustin, a NCAA tournament Memphis team, and SMU, who was a top 50 RPI team. So maybe a team that was getting better down the stretch of last season. And it's too early to preview this team in earnest, but I looked at the spring roster. There are a number of notable Division I transfers, junior forward Ramsey Davis, who was a regular starter at Ole Miss, grad transfer defender Haley Stodden, who had 4 years combined at Colorado and Utah, and sophomore defender Alexis Falks from Texas Tech, along with some notable returnees like CeCe Cross, Anna Reza, Nadia Kamasa, and Alex Whitcraft. I think we were both kind of surprised how big of a step back last year's team took in Jaime Frias' first year, so I think it'll be interesting to see what 2023 looks like with maybe a roster that Frias and his staff have had maybe more of their fingerprints on, plus just another offseason to work with this group.
Yeah, then Cougar Volleyball got its 18-game schedule released as well. There are 13 teams in the Big 12 with Oklahoma State not sponsoring volleyball. So your 12 conference opponents, you play three of them at home twice on back-to-back days, three of them away twice in the same fashion, and then three of them home for a single game, three of them away for a single game for 18 total games. And I think kind of the headlining news, like I mentioned earlier, spoiler alert, the Longhorns coming to the Fertitta Center for two matches, October 13th and 14th. That's a Friday and a Saturday, the Longhorns, notably the reigning national champions. And very notably, this is the Friday-Saturday right after Cougar football plays its Thursday. It's a one Thursday football game on the 12th against West Virginia, which means that U of H volleyball against the Longhorns not taking you away from Cougar football. So put those matches on your calendar, October 13th and 14th. The Longhorns had one loss all of last year in volleyball. It was against Iowa State, a team that was not even, I don't think, as good, it's safe to say, as Houston was last year. Not as good as Houston will be this year, I don't think. But they packed their gym to the rafters. They rode that raucous crowd to an upset win. So I'm telling all of you listeners now, I will tell you again between now and then, I need you to be at the Fertitta Center October 13th and 14th. Really excited about that. And then I think kind of in terms of just like fun home matchups in the Fertitta Center, one of the other two teams that Houston got the two home matches against is UCF, a team that Houston had a real nice budding rivalry with the last couple of years in the American. That series is November 3rd and 4th, annoyingly the same weekend that Cougar football is playing at Baylor. So I think, you know, we can, and you can talk a little bit here about maybe looking at the scheduling difficulty again, but in terms of getting big fun matches in the Fertitta Center, you can't do a whole lot better, I don't think, than getting a combined four matches against UCF and UT Austin.
Yeah, I mean, with all respect to UCF and UCF alone, this is about to be a much tougher but also drastically more exciting conference for this volleyball program that's clearly on this incredible trajectory. Only losing one game last season conference play and watching the Cougars dominate teams was fun, but I think if the team had stayed in the American, that novelty would have worn off pretty quick, and that this coming year's Big 12 slate includes, obviously, the sports defending champion, who was basically the wire-to-wire number one last season, four top 25 opponents, plus one team that ended the year receiving votes. And I think it's really cool how three of the five teams that finished in the top 22 from this new group of Big 12 teams are new members that BYU, UCF, and U of H are bringing so much to the table volleyball-wise. I think it's cool. You're going to face seven different conference opponents who were in last season's NCAA tournament field. So certainly won't be a one-conference loss kind of season, but I think we're both just could not be more excited to see what this team can do coming off its best season in decades, and with the majority of your key contributors returning, because it's worth reminding that you return your top offensive player, Abby Jackson, you return one of the best liberos in the country in Kate Georgiadis, your top two middle blockers, Rachel Tullis and Kellen Morin, the two-headed monster of Annie Cook and Morgan Yanda spearheading your offensive attack at center. And that one area where you lost multiple contributors to graduation, outside hitter, David Rare and his staff brought in Nana Mbanu, a rotation player for last season's runner-up Louisville, Kenneth Sauer, a multi-time first-team All-Big 12 selection at Texas Tech, and Katie Corelli from Ole Miss. Besides men's basketball, Dustin, this is not an especially hot take on my part. There's not a sport I'm more excited about in the coming season than Cougar volleyball. And that's not a slight on the other sports, but I think that's just how good this team can be and how exciting it is to see this team returning as many players as it is and getting to be in a conference that I think is to the level of this program, that this team is now coming into this renaissance and now gets to almost immediately after having its first really good season compete against, I think, more light competition than all of the American programs not named UCF.
Yeah, I think it's, I agree with everything you said. I think it's clearly true that other than men's basketball, this is the most exciting program on campus right now. And it's not, I think it was not wrong that, that in fact, I believe at the Cougar Awards, it actually won Team of the Year after their Sweet 16. You know, a mantle we thought maybe Cougar men's basketball is going to be carrying for a while, but I think well-deserved for the volleyball program to get that. You know, even for the past season, I think heading into the Big 12, have a great chance to be competitive in, you know, maybe at least in the non-UT Austin tier of the Big 12. Because like you mentioned, really deep conference. Baylor, UCF, Houston all finished 16, 17, 18 in the RPI last year, giving the Big 12, yeah, four top 18 teams in the conference. And then you had another four teams that were in the top 40. So it's eight of your 13 members top 40 in the RPI last year. That is some serious level of competition. So you know, it's kind of funny. I think the schedule kind of worked the same way for volleyball as it did for soccer, and I like it for volleyball for the exact same reason that I dislike it for soccer, which is you got more of your road games against some of the lower teams in the conference. You get six of your 10 matches against top 40 RPI teams at home, and you get five of your eight matches against the non, which is, and it's top 40, and then it's like 72 to 169. So it's a pretty, like a clear delineation, at least there was last year, between the eight teams at the top, the five teams at the bottom, and you get five of your eight matches against the five teams at the bottom away. So those, you know, if you can take care of those road matches, particularly against those lower tier teams, then, you know, all of a sudden that sets you up where, you know, you can go and try to win some of those home matches against some of the really good teams. So, like I said, for just a million reasons, you mentioned all the roster breakdown and everything, but also, you know, just looking at this, what a deep conference this is, what a fun conference this is going to be. Just couldn't be more excited about the Cougar volleyball season coming up.
I'm just remembering how much I enjoyed that UCF match at the Fertitta Center last year, and we're gonna get several comparable or better opponents in conference play this year. That's so freaking cool, man. Can it be August already?
Right? I'm ready. Yeah, if not September, at least August. Like, just could be, yeah, just want to pass forward. I'm ready, fast forward. I'm ready to start doing Cougar season previews in earnest and start seeing this team play honest-to-goodness Big 12 competitive games, which we now do have on the schedule for three sports. And I think that is going to be where we're going to go ahead and call it an episode. So on our way out, as always, just want to say thank you so much to all of you out there who have made the generous and kind decision to support the work that Sam and I do on a weekly basis to bring you the best of Cougar athletics by supporting us on Patreon. If you enjoy this episode, enjoy this show on a regular basis, you feel like you're getting some utility out of it, you feel like it's worth $5 a month, we'd love for you to go to patreon.com/shpodcast, sign up to give us $5 a month to not only support the work that we're doing, but also to get access to the bonus content that we're putting out there pretty regularly. You can also, of course, support the podcast by buying some home field apparel with promo code HOMAN12. And we'd love for you to support our podcast network by following the 1012 Network on all the social medias. If you want to get in contact with us, you can email us shpodcast@gmail.com. Please support our Twitter degeneracy by following us on Twitter at @shpodcast. That's it. If you made it all the way to the end of this meaty episode, you are a true American hero. And as always,
go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Vamos los Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
We ain't invited to the party. We had to kick the door in, no cap.